I am Platt on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. When you're running a website like this, wherein you interview people, be they authors, thinkers, journalists, and so on, you begin the endeavor by looking at the people who do this professionally on radio or television. I wasn't a regular listener of my guest now, but how could you not know Sheila Rogers? She's one of Canada's most prominent broadcasters, hosting on all the iconic shows in radio and television in this country. She was the permanent guest host of Morningside. She appeared regularly on This Morning. She hosted Imprint and Saturday Night at the Movies for a spell, and was the host of Sounds Like Canada. She's been hosting CBC Radio 1's The Next Chapter for 4 years now. I've grown a great appreciation and admiration in Ms. Rogers' broadcasting, but also as a citizen. She's done remarkable work raising awareness in mental illness and depression, and she's worked towards reconciliation with Native communities in this country. The Next Chapter airs on CBC Radio 1 Mondays at 1 p.m., Saturdays at 4 p.m. Shelley Ambrose, the Walrus Magazine's publisher, once said of Ms. Rogers, "Think of her as Canada's ear, then add a brain, a heart, and a very recognizable voice." That's Sheila Rogers. I'm very pleased to welcome to the Platt on the Line program Sheila Rogers. Ms. Rogers, good morning.
Good morning, Joseph, and I'm thrilled to be here. I feel like listening to you, I was at my funeral.
Well, let's hope not.
Yeah. Well, it was really nice. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So how long ago was it that you moved to this part of the world, to the West Coast?
The CBC actually moved me out in 2003, and so I've been here almost 10 years and loving it.
Yeah, and so you live on one of the Gulf Islands, right?
I do, yeah, and it's slightly inconvenient, but the beauty of the place more than makes up for it. And my husband, he's retired. He was like the chief technician at the CBC, and he's very, very plugged into our little island. I still do a lot of what I do right across the country and farther east, but it works for us. And I actually think maybe if I was here more often, we might not be as married as we are.
Yeah. So do you do you broadcast the show from there?
You're going to hate this, but yes, I do. I have a studio in my backyard that my husband built for me, and I've got this little black box called a Comrex. And it allows me to attach to either CBC Toronto or CBC Vancouver. And after that, I can talk to anybody in a radio station anywhere in the world.
See, I was wondering, like, when I hear you, and, you know, you do that thing where you say, so-and-so is joining me from our Toronto studio.
Right.
You're obviously not there with them.
Not very often.
Yeah, do you see them, though?
No, I don't see them. And as much as I like seeing who I'm speaking with, if I don't see them, I think it actually puts me more in the mind of the listener, because obviously the listener is doesn't see either me or the guest.
Yeah.
And I think it allows me to think more like them than being the interviewer and just make sure that the listener is included.
Yeah, and I do interviews over the phone. I've started doing interviews in person, but I do find... and I don't know if this is the same for you, that people over the phone will say things that they wouldn't otherwise say were they in person.
I think you're absolutely right. I also think that somehow it creates a space, and it's a sort of, maybe it's a black hole, where people can just think a little bit more. I think when you're face-to-face with someone, the expectation that you're going to answer a question right away is much more present than, say, where we are. I mean, I realize I'm really thinking about your questions, not that I wouldn't if we were face-to-face, but there would be stuff in my gestures and my facial expressions that would signal a lot of stuff to you that you can't see right now, and somehow you have to make sure that your listeners are getting as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'm now much more on the side of not seeing the guest, because I think it does put me in the position of the listener.
And in terms of the guests that appear on The Next Chapter, they're the ones that you want. I mean, you're not in a position where you have to take someone because someone says so, right?
No, I'm very fortunate. I'm now what they call an independent supplier to the CBC. So this is, I sell my services to the CBC. I'm no longer an employee.
Mm.
And it does give me a lot more freedom as to who I put on the air. I do this in conjunction with two wonderful people based in Toronto. I do my bit, and then they sew the program together with music and production in Toronto. They also will write up scripts for me as well. Not all of them. We all share in all of that. But it's there's a lot more freedom, and I also find I have a lot more freedom to do other stuff outside of what I do at the CBC. I don't have to ask anybody's permission anymore, and I really value that.
You know, I was wondering the other day, at the beginning of the show, there's a montage of clips of authors that have been on. Who says your name? There's a certain accent that person has.
That's a woman. She's actually only written one essay, and it was about being adopted, finding out later in life that she was adopted. And she's originally, her heritage is African, and she lived in England and almost stumbled over her parents. But yes, she's the person, and if you keep hearing it, it means we've got to change it.
Yeah,
so we'll switch it up a bit. But it's a real mashup of people that we've talked to over the years.
Yeah, and I mean, I mentioned in the introduction you've hosted, you know, all these legendary programs, these programs that, you know, some of which are still running, like Saturday Night at the Movies.
Right.
Programs that we've all known over the years, like Morningside. This is the best time for you, though, is it?
You know, it's hard to say that it's the best time. I probably will know that in a few more years.
Yeah.
But I have to say I am really enjoying myself. And as I look back on my career, I feel incredibly lucky. I got to work with Peter Zofsky in a very close way. I have no idea why he asked me. And I really am seriously baffled by that. There are so many people who wanted to work with him, to read the letters with him, and for some reason he asked me. I think it was because I was very rude to him when I interviewed him about his very first golf tournament for literacy.
Mm-hmm.
I was so nervous. I decided I could not be reverent because I knew he hated that. And I just kind of switched over to the dark side, and I was playfully rude, and I think he really liked that. I was, I guess, what he would call saucy. And that was a very good time, working with Peter and working at Morningside. But I think, you know, if you were to force me to make a choice, this is the best time. I love what I'm doing on the radio, and I really love what I'm doing off the radio. So it just works.
You know, I was just thinking as you were describing Zofsky, there's no one in broadcasting today that's like him or like that show, isn't there?
I agree with you. I think there are many great broadcasters,
but
there is nobody like him. And when I hear people say so-and-so is the new Peter Zofsky, I also think that's insulting to so-and-so. And usually that's Gian Gameschi.
Mm-hmm.
Gian is a real original. I haven't heard anybody like him. He seems to grow as an interviewer every single program. But he's a very different person from Peter Zofsky. And it's, you know, whenever you heard a female on As It Happens, they would say, oh, yeah, it's the new Barbara Frum. Well, no, you know, they're not the new anybody. They are themselves, and that's the goal, I think, is to be yourself, to be authentic. Because I think the radio will transmit the inauthenticity of voices. Microphones don't lie, I think, even more than cameras. I think it's such a vehicle for intimacy. You're actually entering someone's brain through their ears, and I think you have to be really respectful of that. But I don't think, you know, back to your original statement, no, I think Peter was a one-off. I don't think we'll ever see anybody like him again.
And do you find, because you're in the radio business professionally, that it's still relevant? I mean, with all the technology that we have, I mean, radio was dying in the 70s, they say. yet, you look at what you mentioned, Gian Gameschi, what he's done with that show, his program, Q.
Yeah.
It's getting a new audience. And do you think that radio can sustain itself? I mean,
I absolutely do. I love it when I hear radio's going to die. I just think that it just makes me laugh, you know, and video killed the radio star and so on, and television was going to kill radio. Nothing has killed radio. And I think that's because of the power of the voice. And the voice will always find another way to be heard, as it does on the internet. And I think, too, you know, what Gian is doing with Q and his crew, by the way. He's got a magnificent set of producers, and I know he would want me to acknowledge them as well. They're heard in about 8 different formats, from podcasts mm-hmm. to taking the interviews and putting them on Bold TV. You can hear them live. You can hear them at your convenience on your Android device and so on. I think there's so much more democracy in how you're able to hear someone now, and I think that means that radio will never die. And it's just, again, it's that you can't beat that intimacy. You know, when I hear or see news anchors saying, "Good evening, everyone," mm-hmm. I think that's the difference between television and radio, because I'm not an everyone, I'm just a me. And or if I hear someone on the radio saying, "Hello, everyone," or "you all," there's only me. And often when I'm listening to radio, I'm in my bedroom or I'm in my bathroom, and there's no one else with me. So I think one of the things that Peter really understood about this medium was that you're always talking to the second person singular, not the second person plural. And I think TV is much more of a second person plural kind of medium. So I don't think it's ever going to go.
Yeah. When you left Queens, when you graduated from Queens, did you want to go into radio right away? I mean, was that the goal growing up, say?
It sure wasn't. I was studying art history, and my goal was really to work on doing some conservation work at the Sistine Chapel. I mean, that was a huge goal.
Yeah.
But I was trying to shift myself towards it. I studied Italian. I really loved the Italian Renaissance in my art history courses. And the next thing would have been to try to be accepted to the Art Conservator program at Queens. But I was volunteering at the Queens University radio station, and the fairy tale happened to me. I got a call from the downtown station, and they offered me a job. And once I started doing this, I always loved it as a volunteer, but I never thought it was how I would make my living. But I just couldn't believe you could get paid for it, and I was. And, of course, I was paid very little at first, but yeah. it was just so much fun. I was doing country music. I didn't know anything about country music, and I've always found if I want to learn something, if you can create a program about what you want to learn, then, you know, it's like going to university all over again.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think I got really lucky, Joseph. I got lucky at Queens as well. I wasn't even planning to go to Queens. It was on the dying wish of my late grandmother. And I thought, you don't mess around with that stuff.
Right.
And so I went off to Queens and volunteered at the Queens radio station, and that's, you know, it's what I ended up doing. And I feel, you know, no day has been the same 2 days in a row. I've been so fortunate that way.
Yeah. Other than Zosky, were there other broadcasters or journalists that you grew up admiring?
Yes, absolutely. But Peter was right at the top. Peter, even as a teenager, when I wasn't a CBC person at all, but I grew up in a CBC house, he reached me even as a young, well, you know, someone in my teens. I really heard his voice while he was doing This Country in the Morning. It stood out. It cut through somehow. But yes, there were broadcasters in the music department at the CBC. I mean, I loved the stuff that Glenn Gould was doing on the radio, his documentaries and so on. And there were women that I really admired, too. When Peter left This Country in the Morning, the first person who came to fill in for him was Judy LaMarche, former cabinet minister.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, if that woman can host a program at the CBC, maybe I can, too, someday. And I sort of dismissed that thought and put it aside, but Judy LaMarche was incredible. And then once I actually got to the CBC, I worked with producers whose names I had heard, like Gloria Bishop and Ann Gibson, whose names are at the CBC absolutely legendary, and I worked very closely with both of them for years. So, I still fiercely admire them, and they have left the CBC, but we're still in close touch, and that's been wonderful.
Now, around the time you hosted Sounds Like Canada, was that when, I mean, you had to leave the show because of depression. Was that when it first manifested itself, or is that when it really affected your career and that you had to take time off?
That's an excellent question, because like many people, I wasn't diagnosed until decades into it. I started suffering as a teenager. I went to check it out at the Queen's University, you know, the health department on campus, and the doctor there said that it was really hormonal and that it would pass. And so whenever I wanted to get a diagnosis, I kind of shaped it to be related to something hormonal. I mean, you know, I've had the longest running cases of PMS in history, if that's the case. But 2003 was the year that I was diagnosed, and that really was a year that, it changed everything, because finally I knew what it was, and I could do something about it. And I would say that you are talking to somebody who is in recovery, absolutely. And it's because I've been able to chase it down. I've been able to try to stuff the dragon back into the cave, if you will. Mm-hmm. And now I know what to do when I feel it coming on. I can't always stop it, but it's been wonderful. And I needed, you know, 2003, yeah, I had a very, very severe breakdown then. It lasted 4 months, and I didn't think I was going to come back. I lost my voice completely. You know, losing the ability to talk as a broadcaster is a pretty critical thing. And it did come back as I got better, but it really hit me where I lived. And I'm very grateful that I was able to take that time off. I don't know what I would have done. Well, I couldn't have gone to work, but I was very grateful to be supported through the CBC medical program, which I no longer have access to as a freelancer, yeah. But anyway. But that's, you know, I was able to nail the diagnosis and then really work on it through medication and through therapy, talk therapy.
You know, I remember reading about all this when it happened to you, and it struck me that, looking back at it, I guess, that you were one of the first people in this country, the prominent people, to be so frank and honest about it. I mean, is that true? I mean, I guess it was, right?
Well, I guess I was among the first. And it's funny because, you know, it was 9 years ago. I know there are other people who have talked about it, and I have to say one of my heroes is Ron Ellis, the former Toronto Maple Leaf player, and he wrote a book called Over the Boards, and in it he talks about his hockey career, but he also talks about dealing with depression. And it was so hard for him because, well, not only because he's a man, and I don't mean that as a joke. Mm-hmm. I think it's really hard for men to talk about it. And Ron actually does turn that into a joke. He actually has said to me, men can't ask for help. They can't even ask for directions. But he can say that. I can't. Yeah. But it was hard for him in a really macho profession to say to his comrades, hey, guys, I'm, you know, something's really wrong with me here. Oh, what's wrong? You know, you don't have anything broken. It was just an extremely hard time to get support from your friends and from your family. But he was so, so brave to come out about it. He also makes a joke that, of course, being a Toronto Maple Leaf and not having won the Stanley Cup since 1967 is depressing in its own right. But he's a real hero of mine. And there's Amy Skye, too, who suffered from postpartum depression, the singer-songwriter. And she was talking about it. We were sitting beside each other at Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame celebrating Leonard Cohen. And we were just talking a bit. And I'd interviewed her about her postpartum. And she said, listen, I've heard you are dealing with depression yourself. And I said, yeah. And she said, it would really be helpful if you sort of took it on the road, because you're not afraid of a microphone. You should be getting up there and talking about it. And I make a little sort of rhyming joke. There isn't a day that goes by when I don't think of Amy Skye, and it's true.
Yeah.
The other thing that has been amazing about it is that I've, you know, it's helped me to go and talk about it. I've met amazing people across the country, people who are dealing with so much more than I ever dealt with and who have triumphed or who are really courageous in living it all the way through right now, or with their families or members of their family. I'm filled with admiration for the resilience of so many Canadians.
I should add that in this part of the world, Rafe Mayer was talking about depression for a while.
Oh, yeah, and Rafe, too. Absolutely. You're absolutely right. Yeah, I interviewed him a little bit later after he came out, but I think he was one of the first.
Yeah.
He wrote an essay in Elm Street magazine.
Right.
And, I remember reading it and thinking, oh, my God, that's my story. And I hadn't been diagnosed at that point.
Do you think where we are today, that we're that the stigma around it, about mental illness in general, that it's gotten better?
I think it's better, but it's got miles and miles and kilometers to go.
Indeed.
I last week I was in St. John, New Brunswick, talking to WorkSafe New Brunswick, which is their workers' compensation provincially.
Mm-hmm.
And people came up to me afterwards and said, do you disclose if you have a mental illness? Do you disclose that to your employer? And I think, you know, we're not at the point yet where I can wholeheartedly say yes. You know, nothing will happen to you. You won't lose prime assignments, or you won't be the person who won't be promoted. I can't say that. I think it really has to come down to the individual. And I think when we get to that point where, you know, if I disclose to my employer that I have diabetes or high blood pressure or, I don't know, gout, it's not going to affect my career. But mental illness does. Even when people, you know, there are groups in the country choosing juries where you have to answer questions about, have you ever had a mental illness? Do you suffer from depression? I really feel that's none of their business, and you know what they're really asking, are you fit to be a juror? And I think that's so desperately unfair. It's an illness. It's an illness like anything else, and we've got to get over it. We've got to get over the stigma. It's it still does exist. It exists in popular culture. I remember a couple of years ago, the last episode of House, where he had to be institutionalized, and the institution they put him in at the very end of the season was like a gothic horror house, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then these guys came out to get him, and they're wearing white lab coats and carrying clipboards. And it's just not like that. And we've got to normalize it and take the really hot charge out of it. So are things better? For sure they're better, but they're not where they should be at all.
Back to interviewing. Are there people that you haven't interviewed that you'd still like to?
Yes. There are lots of people I would love to interview. For some reason, and I think it probably goes back to some kind of crush, I've always wanted to talk to Donald Sutherland. I've never talked to Donald Sutherland. But there are people who don't have big names that I always want to talk to. When I hear stories of people in incredible situations, I mean, if I was still doing Sounds Like Canada, I'd like to talk to Mrs. Chrétien, who just found out that her husband was found in the Nevada desert, you know, after all those months. Those are the people who, I mean, they're making it through their lives under just extraordinary circumstances. And those are the stories, I think, that have stayed with me over the years. I have been very fortunate to speak to former prime ministers and politicians and celebrities and so on. I mean, not as many celebrities as Gian is speaking to. Yeah. But my programs and the programs I hosted right to Morningside were never about celebrity. But it was really about people who make a difference, and often celebrities do. I'm not saying that they don't, but that was really more the focus, and so you would hear a lot of people whose names you didn't recognize.
Sheila, this time that we've spent together has just whizzed by. I'm surprised just how we're up to 25 minutes almost. And
wow.
And I really appreciate you coming on today. As I said in the introduction, and I'll say it again, I've been a big fan, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today.
Joseph, it's a real honor, and you know, it's always a good sign in broadcasting when something whizzes by.
Indeed.
the opposite is also true, right?
Yes, yes.
Many thanks, and I really enjoyed talking to you. I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much. The program is called The Next Chapter. It's Mondays at 1 p.m., Saturdays at 4 on CBC Radio 1. It's host Sheila Rogers on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.